There is no way any of you in here have seen the exact same show unless you all, this group, was in the same audience at the same moment. Things change. Actors lose their voices. A prop falls. A door won't open. Things fall out of the ceiling. An actor may have drank too much whiskey. I'm sorry if you saw the show last Saturday.
That's Ron McGee giving a presentation at Creative Mornings KC. He's talking about change, which he knows a lot about. As an actor, he's morphed in and out of many different characters.
Now, here we go. Here's my wrinkled face. This mug is about ready to become Tippi Hedren in The Birds. Bea Arthur from Golden Girls Gone Wild. There's me with the chicken. Betty Gray. She's a prison bitch from hell. Sometimes you're a pinhead. There's me as a man. The mustache is real.
Will the real Ron McGee please stand up? I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is KCUR's Central Standard. This morning's show is an encore broadcast of our portrait session with actor, late-night theater director, and self-described dandy Ron McGee. Hi, Ron.
Yeah, good morning.
For the uninitiated out there, what is late-night theater? Because that's your real claim to fame in town.
Well, late-night theater... we do parodies and camp theater. We used to do it at very late at night. That's why it was called late night theater. But now we do shows at 8 o'clock, and it's adult humor. It's a way to escape for 2 hours.
When you say camp theater, can you flesh that out a little bit?
Well, the way we approach camp is it's a frame of mind where we're putting something up on the stage and then twisting it to the point of humor. And men play women, women play men. Men sometimes play men, and women sometimes play women. And sometimes it's done with puppets.
You've been known to say, and you've just kind of said just now, that it's escapism, that escapism is a big part of it. What do you mean by that?
Our theater, late night theater, I'm not out to change the world. There's theaters in this town and in this country that are there to hold a mirror up and make you reflect on life. And our theater is truly there just for pure escapism, for people to have a moment where they just go away from it all and maybe laugh for 2 hours or see something silly, or they maybe don't like it at all, but they're at least sitting in a room with people that are having an experience, and that's all we really want.
So the performances themselves are little escapes, but does the existence of late night theater mean more than that? I mean, does the existence of late night theater perform a social function?
Well, one wonderful thing is it. I feel that it. Breaks bounds on that the GLBTQ community, and then you have housewives, and then you have workers. One great thing about it is the type of theater that we do has the demographics of the audience alone is something magical. You have Leather Daddy sitting next to Johnson County women, sitting next to hairdressers, sitting next to freedom fighters, and it's wonderful. It's bringing people together.
You know, we heard you joke in your Creative Mornings talk that this is me as a man. I mean, on stage, you do really most often, it seems, play women. What is that like for you?
Well, I feel playing a woman is the most challenging. Women are layered. When you play a woman on stage and you're portraying one, even if they were in a movie or a television show, women have so many layers to them that they're willing to reveal.
What do you mean by that, layers?
That men, especially in America, we're very closed off. It doesn't matter if you're gay or straight or bi. Men are very... we put a wall up. Women are willing to tear bricks out of it and reveal parts of themselves, a personality trait, wickedness, beauty, sadness, and to play a woman means that you have to bring your emotions up, and you have to show pain, and you have to show humor, and I just feel it's so layered. And it also, when doing camp, it brings a camp level. It's one more diffuser for the audience to look through a show when they're seeing a man portraying a woman or a woman portraying a man.
Talk to me about some of your favorite late night roles over the years.
Over the years. Well, interesting. Lately, one of my favorite roles ever was getting to be, I think I can't say the word because you guys bleeped it, but I was in Prison Itches from Hell. I played, it was a film noir styling of women's prison movies. And in it, I played a character that is falsely accused of killing her husband. And it was just really a fun role. And it's fun to do film noir and that style and that fast language that comes with it. And you're just do, 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 do. And then other roles I like. I love playing Bea Arthur in Golden Girls Gone Wild. Anytime I get to play Bea Arthur, I feel like I might be Bea Arthur.
Why do you think you might be Bea Arthur?
Well, I'm the same height as her, and I have that dry humor. And, you know, I constantly go around life going, Ma, you know, just like that. And then other roles I like, Tippi. I love playing Tippi Hedren in The Birds. Joanna Eberhart in Stepford Wives. You know, I like a lot of my roles. But I also, I write these shows, and so I write myself in them, and I pick the role that I really want to play.
Do you, so much of camp actually has to do with playing with stereotypes, it seems. Can you talk about that a little bit more? Because even in just what you were just describing with your recent show set in prison or Stepford Wives, those are real experiences, but they're also stereotypes. And how does camp navigate that territory?
One great thing about camp is you can go to the edge of the edge with stereotype, and you can float it there, and the audience can see the ridiculousness of it, and they really can see it if you add humor to it. And they are laughing through the pain is what I call it, because it's interesting, like Valley of the Dolls. I mean, it's a high camp movie already. And then when you put it on stage, you have these people, you're watching pill and drinking excess to the point of oblivion and to the point where you start laughing about it. And I think it shows an interesting reflection of society. Stereotypes are interesting. I mean, we've all been stereotyped, and it's interesting to play with those aspects. I mean, sometimes when we have a gay character in a show, we're very careful of how far we go with that. Do we put the lisp in? Is it in the movie? Is it something that we want to reflect on? Or is there one bit?
Because usually it is often a parody of an existing movie or television show or something.
Yes, unless we're combining a bunch of thoughts like Prison was. It was several prison movies put together. But many times it's one subject or one movie or one television show. Like our last show, Beetlejuice, was Beetlejuice, the movie. I mean, it was our parody of it. So
some of your roles, I mean, I loved you as Lily Tomlin in Come Back to the 9 to 5, Dolly Parton.
Yes.
Are you a big Lily Tomlin fan?
Yes, I am.
How did you approach not just the character of Lily Tomlin, but then also the character she played in 9 to 5, the movie where, you know, three frustrated women working for the man finally get fed up?
One thing I always say to our actors in late night is to pick three characteristics from the movie to bring out of, like, if you watch certain people, and Lily Tomlin's one, she always crosses her arms. And so how to highlight that always. And when you're playing a character, Lily Tomlin is really just being Lily Tomlin in that movie, is what how I feel. Sometimes actors are portraying different kind of characters. But Lily Tomlin was a really hard one because she's already funny. And so how do you parody funny? So you have to highlight the quirks and the little moments that come about that, a head tilt, a look that she always does. That movie, that movie's incredible. And that David Wayne Reed and Gary Campbell.
David Wayne Reed wrote that.
Yes, he wrote it. And it's one of my all-time favorite shows. It's just so funny. I mean, it's really funny, but it also is interesting because it came out in 1980 and was showing that women were taking power in the workspace. And it's interesting that we're still fighting for that today. A subject in 1980 about women should be paid the same amount as men and not be exploited in the workplace and sexual harassment. Oh, my word, we haven't changed. America has not changed. That movie could be done today and still be topical.
When you were talking about that, you notice a little quirk, and then, I mean, my interpretation would be that you take that quirk and you amplify it. And that seems to be also kind of what you were saying with the stereotypes. You don't back away from the stereotype. You amplify it so that people can see it for what it is. You know, how do you narrow in on those few details that you're really going to magnify?
Well, if you're watching the movie or the television show, like our last show, Beetlejuice, I got to play Winona Ryder. Well, she rolls her eyes at certain moments, even in background.
In that movie, she's a goth. Maybe not. Goth is maybe not right. She's just sort of interested in death and darkness. She's right. A teenager, and her parents don't understand.
Right. That's a really good description of her. She rolls her eyes, and she had these moments. And so I just highlighted her eye rolling to the point where it was over exaggerated. And it's also with the show we're doing.
A Bedrock Christmas.
Bedrock Christmas is, I'm playing Wilma, and she's drawn
from the Flintstones.
And she's drawn with her arms always on her hips. And so I was like, anytime that I'm just standing still, I'm putting my arms on my hips like I've been drawn that way. And it's interesting. It makes the audience remember moments of that show by doing these things. They're like, oh, I remember. That's how that image is in my head, too.
We heard you say that you've been Tippi Hedren from The Birds. What did you do as an actor to spoof that character? I mean, that character, I will say, watching the movie The Birds, Tippi Hedren, in addition to her acting, is her costuming is gorgeous and distinctive.
Oh, yes. I mean, she wears that same green power suit through the whole entire thing, that green dress with that little green jacket. And she wears a fur to go meet them for the day, bringing the birds to Rod. And she's cold as ice. And so, and also, she's a little bit, what's a good word?
Nervous,
and she's not quite there. And that's her acting style. I mean, she's only in two movies, I believe.
So kind of absent.
Absent. And so I played it absent, where you would forget moments. And we also...
Wait, how did you do that? How did you forget moments?
I'd act like I forget my lines, or
like you're just that not there.
Just that not there. And also, we had it told through the eyes of Alfred Hitchcock. So throughout it, he would say cut and make the scene happen again and again. And at times he would torture her to get what he wanted, just like Alfred Hitchcock really did, to try to get the performance he got out of Tippi Hedren. And also he was mad because She didn't take his advances. So there's, you know, many levels there.
When and why did you start late night theater?
It's interesting. First, I would say 1990, I started doing alternative theater, campy theater, through Cafe Lulu, which was Lou Jane Temple's beautiful world. And Mark Manning started The Spoken Word, and I started developing character there. And it ended up being Nasty Sally Searsucker, which is very funny, as we performed in Lou Jane's loft down in Columbus Park. And then from there, I started doing...
Wait, who is Nasty Sally Searsucker?
Well, it was a story of a boy that becomes a drag queen, 1970s drag queen, and becomes the 70s star. And then watches it with a two-faced agent and everything. And she's exploited to the point of oblivion. And then when the 80s arrive with the Reaganism, she dies. She dies of a drug overdose. But we did it all funny. It was really a funny musical. And
counterintuitively, maybe.
Yes. And so that was my first taste of me wanting to do this type of theater. And then I did several little shows here and there for the next couple of years. And then in 1997, me with a bunch of friends decided, well, we could do this all the time. Let's start a theater, call it late night theater, because we went on at 11 at night and in Westport Coffee House in the basement. And so and we started with The Birds. That was our very first show.
Had you always wanted to be an actor?
No. I mean, I do love acting, but I wanted to be an architect. That's what I was dreaming of in high school and going into college. And I wanted to be an architect so bad, but I was told that my style of designing buildings was too out there.
What kinds of buildings were you designing?
Well, I designed a library that you walk through a giant tree. And I thought, gosh, that'd be so cool. You walk through a tree and then all the shelves were branches. And they said it was too out there. And I got tired of drawing, you know, split level suburban homes. And so that's what happened. I look back now and I probably would never have been happy as an architect unless I could have been like, you know, ones that got to bend metal and do wild things. I'm always love architecture. So cool.
Well, I mean, you switched to theater and I mean, you seem on stage like a natural as an actor, like that performing is comfortable for you. But I've heard that until recently you could not perform on stage without throwing up.
Yeah. I get really nervous to perform. I'm not sure the exact words. There's that introvert, extrovert thing and audience. I love audiences, don't get me wrong, but my nerves have always been so bad before I'd go on stage, I would have to puke. And it's the past couple of years, it's finally stopped, but it went on for, well, I'd say 20 some years. I'm a puker.
did you ever question doing something that rattled you that deeply?
You have to go, there's going to be things that rattle you always. And once I'm on stage, it's like a drug or anything. It puts a power in you that makes you feel incredible. You're giving back, and to hear people laugh or silence or to cry there's magical moments on stage. And, that's the part I never want to give up. And so I would fight through that feeling, knowing that in a minute I would be comforted by an audience and other actors.
The venues for late night theater have been the kinds of places with stories. I mean, if, you know, that old phrase, like if walls could talk,
right.
Those are exactly the kinds of places that like make you wish that walls could talk. I mean, after getting started in the basement of Westport Coffee House, you guys moved into your own place. The old Chelsea, near the City Market.
Yes, we did.
Tell me about that theater.
Well, it was an old porn palace down in the River Market. And it was there when it was River Quay in the mafia days. In fact, two buildings around it were gone because they had been blown up during the, you know, the mafia wars. And we were given that. Missy Koontz and Laura North, several people worked with the city and with that the owner of that building to give us that building for 1 year for $1. And we had to go in and clean it. So it
had been abandoned for a while?
Yes, for 2 years. They just walked out of their porn palace. In fact, all the films were still in there. The booths, the seats. And so we had all the seats removed, recovered, re-cushioned. We scrubbed. Everybody worked on it. I mean, every actor, tech person, friends, family got on their hands and knees to clean it. And we had a wild time for 1 year in an old porn palace.
What was it like to work in a space with that kind of history? Did that influence the kinds of performances you did there?
Yes, we one of the shows we decided to tackle, and through Jeff Church's idea, was to do a take on Sweet Charity, and we did Sweet Underground Charity.
So quickly, Sweet Charity. That's what's the quick plot summary?
It's about a hooker with a heart of gold that sees magic in the world, even though she's a hooker. But in our version, we had it as a boy. I played Sweet Charity. And it's about a group of men and women that work in a, in a porn palace. And people come in to watch them dance and then go on dates with them. So it fit really well in there.
So then why did you leave the old Chelsea?
After 1 year, this is so interesting. It was, which we can tell you the dates, September 1st, 2001, they were like, we got to close down. We're going to tear it down. So we had a farewell party called Eve of Destruction on September 10th. And it was John Pinky Cupid had even spray painted that on the front door. And we had this
one of your fellow actors.
We had this blowout party to say goodbye to this building and let people take things because they were going to tear it down, including there was flocked velvet wallpaper in the bathrooms in Kama Sutra positions. But that's beside the point. And I even cut through the wall with a reciprocating saw. And that's how we started the show. And then the next day was 9/11. So
odd, like kind of eerie.
Yes.
The name of that party.
Yeah.
Then there was a little bank on Grand. You transformed a bank into a theater. How did you do that? I mean, theaters have very specific needs.
It's interesting because the KC Pioneers and the Kansas City Leather community, both of them are organizations here in Kansas City. Their guys volunteered, and once again, friends, family. That's really what late night's about. Built risers. We brought over 100 of our seats from the old Chelsea. Built a stage and started a theater. And our tech team built a booth, and David Keel, BJ, and Roger, and Art Kent. I mean, people stepped up to make a theater. You really can have theater anywhere. We could have it right here in this radio room right now. Gina, we just move a desk over there, and I'll put you on top, and we could do a little scene.
You might need a fellow actor.
No, you're good, though.
We'll debate that later. But, after the bank, late night theater disbanded for a little while.
Yes.
During that time, I mean, I never really knew the story of why that was. And I have to say, when I'd see you out and about during that time, you didn't seem like yourself.
Well, it's interesting because late night, I realize, is my calling, and it gives me energy and gives me life. And I wasn't myself at that time. I was lucky enough that to do several fun shows in between there that were late night-esque or had late night people involved in it. But I realized that late night fed my soul. And so that was it was a sad time for me. That's interesting.
Why had it disbanded?
We couldn't afford it. We got too big. The rent was going up because Kansas City Star had just built their building and the Sprint Center was going in, and rent was going up. And you
and
have
that
to,
bank was right there on Grand.
It's right on Grand. And paying the electric bill, the water, gas, everything that you have to do in life to run a space was getting overwhelming. And and we also, you know, paying our actors and tech people, it took us down.
Well, we'll talk about the revival very shortly. When KCUR Central Standard returns, we'll hear about how actor Ron McGee grew up, his family, and being out as a gay man in Kansas City in the 1980s and now. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. We're back. I'm Gina Kaufman, and this is a portrait session starring actor and late night theater director Ron McGee on KCUR's Central Standard. Hi again, Ron.
Hi.
Tell me about your family growing up.
Well, it was magical because it was just my mother and my sister, and we lived in Anaheim, California. I grew up next to Disneyland. So it was a very magical time for me. And that was up to, I think, well, I was 15, and then we moved to Seattle.
Talk to me a little bit about your mom. I don't know anything about her, her background, her personality.
She, outgoing personality, I feel that I have her traits. She was a people person. She was a manager here in Kansas City of Club Royal and booked in acts, including there's a great photo of me somewhere, which I'll post on Facebook, with me little with Roy Clark. My mom, vivacious. She was a beautiful woman.
What were you lived in Anaheim, California, you said, near Disneyland.
Yes.
How did you end up here?
We moved to Seattle, really on the other side of the Puget Sound, into a little logging town called Hoodsport to be with my aunt and uncle. And after 1 year of there, because it rains and stuff, my mom wanted to move back to be closer to family, other family members. And so we moved back to the Midwest, into Kansas City, and really to Blue Springs. And that's where I went to high school.
What were your teen years in Blue Springs like?
Well, at first I was, you know, the odd man out because I was a California kid in Blue Springs, Missouri in 1983. And so it was wild. But then I found my theater group and my friends. And then it all started changing. And I realized I could be me. So it was okay to wear, you know, all black and spike my hair with toothpaste or slick it down and wear three polos.
Three?
Yeah, remember when you pop collar and the one in the middle was kind of droopy?
I don't think I ever really knew that was the sequence, but now that you pointed out, I do remember that.
Yes.
So, I mean, you talked about just being this California kid and feeling out of your element. Can you describe a little bit more what you mean by that?
It's a frame of mind. Growing up in California in the 70s, it was more, I'm not sure this is the right word, but it was more hippy-dippy. I mean, our school was open to the outside, and you had these pits, these carpeted pits. That's where we read in, and, you know, hippies would come and you'd run under parachutes, and it was just a different time. And And then to come back to a more into the Bible Belt and to see a more restrained world, it was a little harsh in the beginning.
I mean, along the lines of restraint, at what point in your life did you start to realize that you were gay?
Well, I think I knew that I was different even when I was really young. Even with my best friends riding our banana seat bikes, you know, I always had a crush on my best friend, Eric. He was so great. And he had a great older brother that taught me about Led Zeppelin and Pink Floyd. But that's beside the point. But I would say in 83, when I finally found my group, that I realized that I could be me. And
that was included in that?
Yes.
Do you have a coming out story?
Well, I have several coming out stories. I mean, on the grounds that I came out early on in high school with my friends. And because I was finding like-minded people. And then I was brought out of the closet on accident in an article in the Star in the early 90s that they listed that I was gay, a gay performer. And I was like, well, now I'm really, really out. But
you had not considered yourself really fully out until that appeared in a newspaper article?
Yes. I mean, I was really being just me. I mean, it's not like I wasn't hiding who I was. I mean, I was wearing flamboyant clothes or doing what I wanted to do even then. But it was interesting that it was like, well, now the world knows, you know. That's when newspapers were, you know, relevant. I mean, people were really reading them then, you know.
What did that feel like for you?
Well, it was a great load off of my shoulders. I mean, there's no more hiding anything. The only regret that I have is I never truly came out to my mother. And when I did, it was on her deathbed. So, you know, that's my only regret. And I don't have very many regrets. I don't, I believe we need to embrace our past and things that have happened in your past, and everything is a layer. And but that one sits up there as a regret, because my mother, she was accepting of the world. And I think that we could have had some more times together, even as she was getting ill, that could have been more magical, even though she saw my shows. And even as she was sick, she would hold a tissue over her mouth because of the fog machine. And also we smoked on stage, and she was always proud. And she was a proud woman. So that's interesting. Boy, we went somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, do you mind talking about what kept you from telling her?
I don't. Coming out is an interesting thing. That we have this thing called coming out, coming out of a closet, opening up. It's about being a person. And I'm not sure why we put these restraints up. I mean, a person's a person, but I didn't want to disappoint her by saying it. And in deep down, I realized there would have been no disappointment. And that was something in my own mind that I didn't deal with.
What was Kansas City like for the gay community at that time in the 80s?
Well, I mean, it was a different time. You had bars, gay bars. Some of them you had to be buzzed into. You had to become a member so that they knew who they were buzzing into the bar. It was bars were still raided then. Some places you couldn't, they still had laws on the books that people couldn't, two men couldn't dance together unless there were a certain space between them. One of my good friends, two of my girlfriends who are still my friends to this day, which is so interesting. Facebook is so bizarre because you stay friends with people, Carolyn and Michelle. we would switch off them coming with me so that it looked like I had a girlfriend until we got into the space, and then we could split back apart and be ourselves. Also, there was laws on the books that drag queens had to wear 3 pieces of men's clothing. I mean, it was a, even though it was a darker time, it was really a fun time. Yeah. Even though you were sneaking down an alley to get to a place that like-minded people were at, it still was a really good time.
What was fun about it?
It was freeing. You would leave Blue Springs in your best friend's CRX and then change clothes in the car on the freeway as you were going. And then by the time you got there, you had hid a peach schnapps in your coat pocket. And it was, and also this is one of the great things, which I think is a problem with bars today, is most of those clubs or bars were 18 and older, and you were stamped that you couldn't drink if you were under 21. But that then meant that older gay and lesbians were there, and they became your mentors and your guidance. And they taught you culture. They taught you camp. They taught you what movies to see and things that would help you in becoming you. And I think it's something we're lacking in today's society, is we don't have that older people stepping forward and trying to be a voice to help the younger face these hurdles.
You know, I've wondered if, do you see yourself as that kind of mentor? After the Orlando nightclub shooting, you were a really vocal presence on social media, and I noticed that you reached out really explicitly to young members of the LGBTQ community and let them know that you were there for them if they were scared or felt isolated. Can you talk about your decision to really just explicitly make yourself available in that way?
I feel it is every GLBTQ's duty as you get older is to help guide younger people to realize that, A, it is not a mental disorder, that this is who they are. This is a beautiful thing about them. And I was really worried after that tragedy that people would go back into the closet or not be themselves, or worse, commit suicide or think that they're not worth anything. And they are. Everybody should be given a chance to be who they want to be. And it really was upsetting to me. And I did reach out to the younger people, and people have come up, and it's fun to tell stories for them and for them to realize that there has been struggles for us all to be at this point.
Ron McGee, we've got to take one more break, but we'll pick up where we left off. This is KCUR Central Standard. When we return, more with Ron McGee. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back. We just have a little while left for today's portrait session on KCUR's Central Standard, where we've been getting to know actor, director, and self-described dandy, Ron McGee of late night theater fame. Hi again, Ron.
Hi.
Our portrait sessions are interviews paired with photographic portraits by the talented Paul Andrews. We'll have both online later today at kcur.org/centralstandard. And Ron, we were just talking about the importance of mentorship. You've talked in the past about your art family in Kansas City. Who is your art family and what does that mean?
An art family for me is a group of like-minded people or people that can guide you in your life. My art mom is Lou Jane Temple. And since 1989 on, she's been there for me. She's the Auntie Mame in my life. She is a force, and she's always been for people to create their art. And so she's the leader of it all. And art family, and I have so many great people that are in my art world. And
do artists need art families? And if so, why?
Yes. I always feel people need an art family, but they need it for the support to there's times when you have doubt as an artist. It doesn't matter what type of art you do. And these are the people that say, go for it, and help you, guide you through it, or tell you things that happened in their past that will give you guidance. I love being part of an art family. One great thing about Kansas City is we're one of the few cities that I've ever been in that painters, musicians, artists, theater people, actors, tech people, dancers, we all are one group together instead of divided. And that's why you get to see such creative things happen around this city is people come together and help each other. It's very interesting. It doesn't happen in other cities that I've been in.
As far as family, you're married.
Yes.
And you got married before that marriage was legally recognized. What made you decide to do that?
Well, first off, John Fulton Adams, I realized after 1 year together, and now we've been together 10 years, that he was my true best friend, someone that I wanted to conquer this world with together and explore this world. And I didn't want to lose that that connection. And we talked about it. We wanted a commitment to say that, hey, we're here for each other, and that's why we did it.
You, the two of you have a house that you named your house Chestnut House.
Yes.
And you've described it before as being like set design for your life.
Yes.
Can you describe the house and describe what having set design for your life means?
Well, it's a 1884 crumbling Queen Anne Gothic Victorian. And John, because he's a fashion designer and visual designer, and myself, being an actor and designer, we like to stage our house in different vignettes. And we stage it to the point where it feels like you're in a movie or a set. Or
can you tell us about one vignette?
Well, we have a cabinet of curiosities, which has many taxidermy pieces and bottles, and it's with a chaise in front of it for you to read, and mirrors, and it's truly a representation of John and I, and it's our collection over 10 years because we get things together.
So living basically in the theater of your life, I mean, how do the objects you surround yourself with influence you?
Well, if you surround yourself with really fun things, your life is going to be fun no matter what. I always wonder when people have really stark homes, where does their creativity come from? I mean, if only you have a floating sofa in the middle of your house, how are you going to be creative in that? I want things to inspire me, or I can get lost in. I can get lost in my house easily for several days.
Where else do you find your inspiration? Because, I mean, you've got this show, Bedrock Christmas. It's a Flintstones show. You know, the inspiration seems to be really wide-ranging. We've got Hitchcock. We've got the Flintstones.
It depends on you know, you're drinking with your friends, your art family, and you all of a sudden, like, ideas start throwing around, and like, wouldn't it be funny is to do an adult cartoon version of the Flintstones? And then art designer Chad, who designed our set, which is phenomenal, he came up with the Flintstoners, and from that we ran with it. And so there's a woolly mammoth bong on stage, you know, that talks. It's a puppet bong. And the Fred and Barney characters, I mean, they have to, you know, get high to get through the holidays. So we just thought that was really funny.
Well, does your late night theater, as we mentioned before, disbanded for a while, it has gotten back together and taken on a new form. And I wonder if your approach to theater changes with you and matures with you over time, or if you feel some pressure to be the same wild and crazy guy you were in your youth, or if you feel free to change and evolve in whatever way.
That's a very good question. I feel that I have evolved. We're still, you know, put on wildly campier shows, though now it's only at 8 o'clock or 6 o'clock on Sundays. One great thing is we're at Missy B's, and the other two producers, Jessica Dressler and Chadwick Brooks, have worked really hard to keep the late night flame going, aesthetic. So one great thing about it is it's so much more freeing at this space because we don't have the headaches of, oh, ASCAP, how we're going to pay ASCAP for the electric bill or heating. And so it is a lot more freeing. And we also, our stages...
To exist in someone else's umbrella.
Yes. And the stage is a certain size, so we know we can only do a show this size. And the dressing rooms, you know, at intermission, people don't realize this in the audience, but the drag queens for the show after ours that starts at 10:30, they're already coming in and starting to get made up in the back. So we have to start shrinking our backstage area. So we have to...
Throughout the course of the show.
Through the show. And then we have to, you know, at the end of the show, we have to move 100 people out of that space. And it has to be completely reconfigured seat-wise. Walls are moved. And then they have a drag show. And then that bar is so phenomenal with that staff is they then switch out all of those seats and then make it a dance club. It's really wild to share. It's fun. And we've got it down. It's like a really good system.
Ron, there's a term that I've used a couple times in the show that I've said that you are a self-described dandy. And I don't want to let the hour go by without asking you what that means.
It's a frame of mind. It's a style. It's believing in yourself. I know that dandyism, people think of, you know, 17, 1800s. And even into the 1900s, because Edwardian had the dandyism. And
what was Edwardian dandyism?
You know, it was wearing high-end clothing and aesthetic and allowing your ennui to show when you stepped outside sometimes. And John and I have taken on that style that we're going to be ourselves, and dandies have always been themselves, and so we're kind of these modern-day dandies. I'm happy to wear polka dots or curvat.
You are wearing polka dots right now.
I am. I did that for you. I did dress up. See, I've dressed up for the radio. That was a big deal. People said, oh, wear anything. No, you got to look nice because Gene's got to look at me this whole hour.
But tell me more about your idea of what it means to be a dandy, because you could use a lot of terms to describe people who are being themselves. And it does seem like you're alluding maybe to an aesthetic, maybe to something more.
No, it's an aesthetic. It's like one thing that that we strive to be is good hosts, to make sure that we're really good hosts, to understand our friends, to make sure that they're always happy. That's something that dandies do, and to be themselves.
Well, our time is up for this conversation with Ron McGee of Late Night Theater. Ron, it's been a lot of fun to learn a lot more about you. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, thank you so very much.
This show has been part of our Portrait Session series, where we have in-depth interviews getting to know the most interesting people in Kansas City. We pair those interviews with photographic portraits online. The photos are by Paul Andrews, and you can find them at kcur.org/Central Standard. That's where you'll find this interview later today. It's the weekend, but stay in touch on Twitter. We are at KCURCST. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, and Andrea Tudhope. Our interns are Raven Brooks and Aaron Pelish. Our portrait session partner is Paul Andrews, and our theme music is by Spoonbender Labs. Linda Scher runs the board for us. I'm Gina Kaufman, and if over the weekend you've got some listening time, we had lots of great shows this week. You can find them all at kcur.org/centralstandard. I'm Gina Kaufman. Have a great weekend.